KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo nerd.
Hey, Ray!
Hey, Dave. Thought I'd change it up a little bit.
You know, it sounded like you had a CD stutter. Remember those?
Yeah. So, man, what's going on?
Well, it is winter, the day before the winter solstice here in Ojai, California, and it's 70 degrees today. Tomorrow it's going to be 80.
Dude.
And you?
And you. Yes, well, it's finally Alaska out there today, and we have a couple of inches of snow on the ground from last night, and maybe 7 to 8 more inches coming all day long.
Great,
and more snow tonight.
Love that shoveling.
And then it turns to rain on top of that. So we'll see what happens.
So you'll be slipping down the steep roads of Ketchikan,
yes,
Alaska.
Yes, and we live up on a hill, so it's always dramatic here. So, yeah.
Before we get into our most amazing guest and one of the best topics ever of all the paleo episodes you could ever be.
Yeah. Here we go.
What do you know about the strange hypothesis that a giant kraken...
Oh,
arrange the bones of the ichthyosaurs in Berlin. What's it called?
Berlin State Park.
State Park?
Yeah, State Park.
The ichthyosaurs,
yeah.
State Park in Nevada.
In Nevada.
I think a paper just came out that it's possibly a death maternity ward because there's adults and individuals. And then some crazy kook said...
Well, years ago...
No, the bones were placed... Yeah, let's hear it.
Years ago, there was a hypothesis that this strange assemblage of ichthyosaur bones, these Triassic ichthyosaur bones, and they're big ichthyosaurs, were arranged in...
Shonosauruses.
But still, you know, yeah, there's still a lot of debate as to what genus is. But anyways, these giant ichthyosaurs, and there was this kind of way out there idea that maybe a giant squid, a kraken, had arranged their bones kind of doodling around, and even maybe suggested that it might have been sort of a self-portrait of the kraken. So,
yeah. And I haven't seen the morphology of the site. Have you? And
no, it's on my bucket list, man. I want to go there. And you're in California. Oh. We could drive over to Nevada. Let's go someday.
Yeah,
let's
do it. But what I'm saying is the assemblage of bones, how could anybody assume that an intelligent creature placed them in? Are they weirdly placed? Are they stacked? They're not articulated?
Are they
stacked in little smiley faces?
Articulated. I didn't go deep into the paper, the latest paper, that the hypothesis is that it might be a birthing site. But even then, and that's the beauty of science. You run these ideas out there and people take pot shots at it. And so there's been even people challenging that idea, even though the group...
Is there a reason for the mass death?
Well, that's what they're still.
Or algae bloom?
There's those theories. Behavior does not fossilize. You have to infer a lot. You know, so there's
I love that.
And they
wait a minute. Wait. No. Some behavior does fossilize,
right?
As in Dean Lomax, Locked in Time.
Well, footprints do that kind of thing too. And so you can still, but you know, you still can't have a snapshot exactly. But you do the rigorous science. I think they found baby ichthyosaur bones in the same site, so maybe there's a chance they were crawling up the land, having the babies there, and this is the spot. Would it make sense? Or did you get live birth?
Oh, because,
maybe.
Ichthyosaurs are marine reptiles.
Wait,
they have to breathe. Wait, they breathe air.
Yes, they breathe air.
Yeah.
They're reptiles going back to the sea. And so they've got to breathe there. And do they lay their eggs up on the beach?
I want to dive in. Let's get an ichthyosaur expert. Well, Dean Lomax.
Well, we did it.
But we didn't do the Berlin site. Let's talk to someone about the Berlin site.
Okay, we can do that. I know a guy who knows a guy.
Okay, so now, what is the most famous, iconic dinosaur? What is it? Come on.
Brontosaurus.
That's the little plastic model.
Yeah, now it's a Apatosaurus, and then it's back to the Brontosaurus now.
Come on.
Well, it's T-Rex. It's the king.
Wait, do you hear his roar? Do you hear him?
Is he out there? Oh, man, I'm scared.
Oh, my God, that's scary.
Oh, there's my coffee cup. The little ripples are in it.
And who are we talking to?
Well, we're going to meet Tom Holtz. He's a vertebrate paleontologist, acknowledged as probably one of the foremost authorities on Tyrannosaurus rex. And he's in Maryland. Yes. We're going to call him up. I've never met him. I'm super excited. This is going to be a meeting for both of us. So call him up, man.
Okay.
Hey, Dave, meet Tom Holtz, vertebrate paleontologist, author of numerous books. He's a principal lecturer at the University of Maryland's Department of Geology. He's worked on the Walking with Dinosaurs BBC series, as well as being featured in many documentaries like Jurassic Fight Club, Monsters Resurrected, Dinosaur Revolution, and Clash of the Dinosaurs on the Discovery Channel, and more.
That's great.
Did I get it right?
Yes, yes, indeed. And I'm federally obliged to add that I'm also a research associate with the Department of Paleobiology at the National Museum of Natural History, which I have a badge to get into the Smithsonian collections and work on fossils.
And is this part of the $1.7 trillion budget that you had to say that federally?
Federally mandated.
That's right.
Well, exactly. Welcome to Paleo Nerds. I know the answer to this. we ask all our guests, Tom, are you a paleo nerd?
I'm not merely a paleo nerd. I am also, as I have said in print, the self-proclaimed king of the dino geeks. So,
king of the dino geeks. And we want to talk about the king of the dinosaurs with you, too. But I understand that you were actually born a paleo nerd, more or less. Mom got you some plastic dinosaurs. This happened to me, too.
As we all had them, yeah.
And that was it for you. But you actually wanted to be a dinosaur. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, when I was really young, like three-ish or so, I got a couple of dinosaur toys. They were a Tyrannosaurus and a Brontosaurus, as it was called then, and is called again.
Yes.
I was, at the time, you know, I asked my mom, you know, what are these things? And she said, they're dinosaurs. And apparently I looked at her kind of skeptically, because how could these two things, which look so different from each other, be called the same thing when a horse isn't called a cow and a lion is not called a tiger? And so she didn't know what the answer was, but she came from a background in education. And so she got me a dinosaur book. In fact, specifically, it was the How and Why Wonder Book of Dinosaurs from an old, you know, 1950s and 60s kid series.
Could even be a golden book.
Yeah, yeah. Although I did get the golden book not long after that. The big golden book, especially.
Right.
With the Zellinger art. But in going through that book, you know, that just, you know, said, okay, this is it. I've now know a bit about dinosaurs. So when I grow up, I'm going to be one. In fact, specifically, I was going to be Tyrannosaurus, because if you're going to be a dinosaur, you might as well be the king.
Yeah.
Eventually, you know, they broke it to me that that wasn't going to happen. So I decided I was going to do the next best thing and study them instead. And unlike most people, I stuck with my decision that I made when I was 3 years old. If more people did that, I think there'd be a lot more astronauts and firemen and so forth and ballerinas than there are in real life.
You sure have studied them.
Yes, and you know, my course was set as I want to get that crayon, and I was drawing dinosaurs as a kid.
There you go.
First thing, I was drawing them, and I'm 68 years old. I'm still drawing dinosaurs with crayons, so I haven't gone far in life. But you actually managed to make a living, your passion early on, and you ended up going to Yale and working with John Ostrom.
That's right, yeah. Got lucky enough to be accepted at Yale, working with Ostrom as his last student while he was a full-time faculty member.
Wow.
And that was...
What years are these? These are...
So I entered in 87, and my last class was in 91, and then I wrote the dissertation in sort of 92 and defended in 92, and the degree is in 93.
And for our listeners, Ostrom is pivotal in paleontology. He named hadrosaurs. Brief description of Ostrom from your point of view?
Sure. Yeah, and actually, and sort of in his background, he's different than you or me in that he didn't start from a young age interested in dinosaurs. He assumed when he went off to college that he was going to follow in his dad's footsteps and go into something in medical. Yeah, so for medicine, whether it's a doctor or dentist or something along those lines. And as part of his undergrad, he had to take a certain number of classes in biology that weren't pre-med focused. And this is a good thing, and I'm glad some departments still do that.
and he managed to take a course on evolutionary biology. And then it was like, bing,
yeah,
okay.
Holy cow. Yeah.
This is something that really got his interest. So at a time when dinosaur paleontology was kind of at a low, so you have 50s into the early 60s, there wasn't as much research being done on dinosaurs, you know, even worldwide. Compared
they were
to...
gray, slow, and lumbering.
Exactly. So, you know, compared to the pre-Depression era, there's a lot of active dinosaur research going on. Nowadays, of course, it's going incredibly well. But in that middle part of the century, very little primary research. But he was one of the ones who was doing that. He worked with Ned Colbert, who was a great paleontologist in his own right, one of the key figures of the mid-century at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. And Ostrom started working on first revising hadrosaurs, so the duckbill dinosaurs, which had been typically interpreted as these slow-moving swamp dwellers whose jaws were inadequate for eating anything but the softest of aquatic vegetation. And so Ostrom's looking at these jaws and said, no, these are amazingly adapted for processing, you know, tremendous amounts of vegetation. And then in his postdoc work, he started working on ceratopsids, on horned dinosaurs, and found a similar suite of adaptations. These are dinosaurs really well adapted for breaking food up, large volumes of food into really tiny bits. And he understood that one of the key aspects of physiology is your ability to get nutrients into your body quickly. And the way to do that is to take large volumes and break them down into small bits, because chemistry works on surface area. You got to get those enzymes hitting the molecules on the edge of the particles of food. And he said, well, why would these dinosaurs have these adaptations unless they had a higher metabolic rate than something like a lizard or a turtle and so forth? And so already he was beginning to think that the old model of dinosaurs being these slow, sluggish, cold-blooded animals was wrong. Yeah.
He was groundbreaking.
Exactly. And then he got his job at Yale, and early on there, he sort of reopened work on the Cloverleaf Formation, which was, as he said at the time, was sort of the twilight zone. It was the The Cloverleaf Formation outcrops in Wyoming and Montana.
So it's Cretaceous.
Sort of middle, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, we'd long known the rocks of the late Jurassic, the Morrison Formation in the American West, you know, Brachiosaurus, Stegosaurus, Allosaurus, Apatosaurus, Brontosaurus, Diplodocus, those are super well known. And then the late Cretaceous dinosaurs from the Judith River and the Hell Creek and so forth, the Tyrannosaurs and the Horned dinosaurs and the Duckbills, all super well known. But this interval in between was sort of a twilight zone at the time. And there have been bones found in the 1930s. But very little work had been done on them. But they knew where the outcrops were. So we went back out there. They were finding plant-eating dinosaurs. And okay, they're cool. But 1964, on the way back from the working in the field, getting back to like break camp, he came across the claw of a small carnivorous dinosaur. And that's cool. Because, all right.
Oh,
small carnivorous dinosaur.
Deinonychus.
Yeah. Say it again,
right? Deinonychus.
Ostrom preferred the pronunciation Deinonychus, but honestly, you know, the dinosaurs are dead.
Tom, I get them wrong. I always get it wrong anyway. So
a lot of people use that pronunciation too, so that's fine.
It's all right, Dave.
So they went back the next year to that spot, found the rest, or at least most of the rest of the animal. And this was for the very first time a raptor dinosaur, a dromaeosaur, known from relatively complete material. There had been bits and pieces found since the early days of the 20th century, but nothing really complete. This fancy claw turned out to be on the foot, which was a huge surprise, because how are you going to use a claw like that? You're going to want to, you know, jab the ankles of other dinosaurs? That didn't seem very likely.
Trip them.
Exactly. So he pictured them as something much more like a big cat, being able to leap up and slash and stab and eviscerate the prey, which went against sort of the prevailing model of even carnivorous dinosaurs at the time, where they picture them basically as Komodo dragons walking on two legs. And here's something that's more like a hawk or like a two-legged cat. And then shortly thereafter, when writing up the osteology of Deinonychus, and at the same time encountering more information about Archaeopteryx, at the time the oldest known bird, he began to notice bone for bone the real incredible similarity between dromaeosaurs like Deinonychus and early birds like Archaeopteryx revived and even modified an old model, which was that dinosaurs were close to the bird ancestry. And in fact, right. The modification is that birds were actually the descendants of dinosaurs and were closer to things like Deinonychus than Deinonychus was to Tyrannosaurus or Allosaurus or the other carnivorous dinosaurs.
Are most raptors dromaeosaurs?
Yeah, so the main cluster of raptor dinosaurs are the dromaeosaurs. So right. Velociraptor, Dromaeosaurus, Deinonychus, Utah raptor.
Got it.
There's another branch called the Troodontids.
Troodontids. So more bird-like.
Yeah, best known for Troodon and some close relatives like Sauronathoides and so forth. A little bigger brained, a little less powerful in terms of their predatory equipment.
And they have interesting dentition, the Troodontids.
Exactly, yes. So between these different lines of evidence, you know, plant eaters with adaptations to acquire lots of food, the very bird-like nature of Deinonychus, and the fact that Deinonychus was built to hunt in a style very different than people thought a dinosaur could hunt, it began to get them thinking that maybe all dinosaurs had an elevated metabolism. Maybe they were warm-blooded dinosaurs. And then, of course, his undergraduate student, Robert T. Bacher, Bob Bacher, took that ball and ran with it.
And sort of wrote Dinosaur Heresies, which
exactly.
Dr. Bob on before, too, and we've had Jingmei O'Connor talking about the troodontids and the birds.
But enough about them.
Let's talk about the king, shall we?
Sure, absolutely.
So wait, what did you call him, a T-Rexpert?
Yes, he's a T-Rexpert. It's not my pun. It was actually used in another interview, wasn't that, Tom?
I think so, yeah. Yeah,
but you are the king of dinosaur geeks, and you have achieved this kingly crown because you are a T-Rexpert, one of the world's most foremost authorities on Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yep.
Just actually, maybe, why is it so darn cool? Why do we pay respect to the king?
Oh, T-Rexes are boring. Come on.
Yeah.
They eat lawyers. They chase people in jeeps.
Right.
Push back on that.
Sure, exactly. So anyone who works on anything other than Tyrannosaurus has to try to put it down when they're talking about how cool their things are. And that's because haters gotta hate. They gotta try to take down the big guy to make their own things look cool. No, but yeah, Tyrannosaurus is an awesome creature for a number of reasons.
Okay.
Historically, it was significant in terms of human paleontological history because in the 19th century, people had found, a handful of carnivorous dinosaurs, Allosaurus and Ceratosaurus over here in North America, Megalosaurus over in the UK, and those were impressive compared to any modern terrestrial predator. And then along comes, at the dawn of the 20th century, a creature that dwarfs them. You know, Tyrannosaurus Rex, if it could rear up, it could look up into a second-story window. It's got teeth the size of bananas, and so forth. And it sort of blew people away and had the advantage of being named by one of the greatest propagandists of dinosaur or paleontology of all.
Was it Barnum?
Barnum discovered it, and right. Henry Fairfield Osborne, his boss, is the one who named it and made it the showcase and centerpiece of the new exhibits at the American Museum of Natural History. So here you are in the publishing center of the world with this most spectacular creature. And so its picture gets out all over the place. It's one of the first dinosaurs to make it into the pictures in terms of movies. Ghost of Slumber Mountain, which came out, within a decade or so of it getting named. One of the first stop-motion movies ever done featured the perennial image, Tyrannosaurus battling Triceratops.
That's not Gertie the dinosaur. No, Gertie
is
a brontosaurus.
Exactly. That's the very first. And that's like old-fashioned pen and ink animation.
Right.
This was the first stop motion. So, clay
what
models.
What did it look like? Did it look like a T-Rex? Like the old-fashioned T-Rexes?
It's the old-fashioned T-Rex. Very upright. And so forth. Still had three-fingered hands at the time.
Mm-mm.
So Tyrannosaurus sort of reached the public consciousness pretty early in dinosaur history, and therefore, it's became one of the iconic ones and has been ever since. But independent of that, the actual organism itself,
yes,
scientifically, is a very cool creature. It's arguably the largest of the carnivorous dinosaurs.
Ever? You mean ever? Larger than Spinosaurus?
Yeah, it seems to be more massive than Spinosaurus, right. Although not as long, because right. It's more compactly built.
We don't care about length, Ray.
Yeah, girth is more important here. And in fact, that is actually an issue with the Tyrannosaurus, because as it turns out, that girth is going to be significant with regard to their agility. But that's newer discoveries. I'll talk about that later. So it's gigantic. And that in and of itself isn't, and that is cool. But it also means, it shows us that you could be a functioning predatory land animal on the scale of an orca.
Right.
Right.
Which, you know, we don't have anything like that in the Cenozoic. There's nothing like that in the Paleozoic. It's something that only dinosaurs were able to achieve. It's the last member of a long history of tyrannosaurs. And in almost every way, it's the most extreme. It's largest in size. It has the proportionally largest and therefore fewest number of teeth. It is the best binocular vision. It's got the biggest brain of the tyrannosaurs, at least in absolute terms.
Wait, you mentioned that they have a hard palate.
They have a hard palate? Exactly.
What does not have a hard palate in the carnivorous dinosaur? And what does it mean?
Sure. So if you raise your tongue behind your teeth, you could feel there's a solid wall of bone where the bones from
the roof of your mouth
come together. So bone sheets of bone coming from the maxillae, the sides of our jaws, come together, and that's normal for us. Mammals have that, and we've had that for ages and ages. Crocodilians also have that. They evolved it independently, and we can even trace in the history of crocodilians how that palate first forms and then moves backwards. And functionally, it does a couple things, one of which is you're able to bite down and twist, because it is able to transmit the forces through the skull much more effectively. So you could either bite down and twist and sort of use torsional forces, or you could bite unilaterally, bite on one side really hard.
You mean it gives structure to the mouth?
It gives structure to the whole jaw. If you look at most other carnivorous reptiles, they don't have that. So if you look at something like a carnivorous lizard, like a monitor lizard or a mosasaur, yeah, a Komodo dragon. If you look at a more primitive carnivorous dinosaur, like an Allosaurus or a Ceratosaurus, they don't have that sheet of bone coming across. And so they were probably pretty good at bilateral biting. So both rows of teeth biting at the same time.
What do you mean bilateral?
Both sides. Just
both sides, both left and right teeth contacting the meat at the same time.
Right.
And they're probably pretty good at biting straight down and pulling out, but not for grabbing on and twisting and tearing and yanking off chunks of meat. Whereas a tyrannosaur with a secondary palate, not as extensive as crocodilians have and as mammals have, but more extensive than other carnivorous dinosaurs, could do that. It could bite down, clamp down, and just twist and yank and tear and pull. And to power that, the muscles on the back of the skull that we can infer because of the shape and size of the bones of the back of the skull were massive on Tyrannosaurus, much more massive than an Allosaurus and its kin, or the Ceratosaurus, or Spinosaurus.
But the T-Rex's teeth are not steak knives. They're actually made for that ripping. Puncturing, ripping, and crushing rather than slicing.
Precisely. Yeah, so that the more ancestral mode was to get in there, slice out some meat, and pull it out. And those steak knife teeth of earlier meat eaters are perfectly good for that. They really do look like steak knives. So get in there and just slice out. Tyrannosaurs and Tyrannosaurus rex, most of all, because it's the most extreme, are very thick from side to side.
The teeth are very thick from side to side.
And they're deeply rooted. About two-thirds of the tooth is up in the jaw, whereas in Allosaurus, it's about one-half of the tooth is in the jaw. So it's able to smash into the flesh, smash into the bone, grab on there, yank back and forth, and just pull out big chunks of meat. And we even find at the other end of the digestive system, out in coprolites or dino poop.
The poop, yes.
Yeah, Tyrannosaurus poop that's got smashed bits of plant-eating dinosaurs in it. So they were taking down not just the meat, they're eating the bone as well, and getting pulverized before they actually swallowed it.
know that there are teeth marks that match. Right. I've seen them at the Museum of the Rockies. T-Rex is on Triceratops and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But is there evidence of an actual bite? You know, like you would bite into a pickle? A bite taken out of a hadrosaur that is like beautifully matched? I mean, I know there are teeth marks, but there's no evidence of a giant bite.
Well, we actually have a couple cases in both Edmontosaurus, so the big duck bill of the time, and in Triceratops, of course, the most famous of the horned dinosaurs, which was T-Rex's contemporary. Individuals that were bitten by T-Rex that managed to get away. So there's, in the case of Edmontosaurus, the duck bill, in one case, there's a specimen in Denver that looks like it has some of the bones of the upper part of its tail chomped out, and the punctures around it seem consistent with a Tyrannosaurus bite, yet those bones are slightly healed over. So it lived to see another day. So a bit, a living animal in pain. Now, there are some who question whether that particular wound is actually a bite and maybe instead some other sort of abscess.
Sure.
But they can't say that about another case of a duckbill where the actual tip of the Tyrannosaurus tooth broke off in the tail bones, and then that healed over. And so there's only one way that could happen.
Isn't there a tooth in a face somewhere?
There may be, and there definitely is in the case of Triceratops, a Triceratops horn that is bitten off with puncture marks that are consistent with T-Rex bites that has healed over. So
Seems the whole thing that we're kind of dancing around here, too, can you prove that they were, you know, chasing down the prey? Of course, Jack Porter has been on the show with us, and he postulated years and years ago that it was merely a scavenger, and there was tremendous pushback on that.
Right.
And what is your, where do you come down in that debate? Is it, and I know you've been studying the legs, and then there's the tiny arms thing.
Yeah, you did some work on
the tiny arms.
Yep.
So where do you fall on the predator scavenger spectrum of things these days?
Yeah, back in 2008, I wrote sort of what at the time was intended to be the definitive rebuttal of at least the obligate scavenger hypothesis. So the idea that they scavenge—that's certainly reason. In fact, it's not only reasonable; that's the expectation. There are very few carnivorous animals that pass up a free meal that doesn't fight back. So scavenging is a common mode of feeding for meat eaters, for carnivores. But the idea that it was an obligate scavenger, that it had
to
be
obligated. That's all it could do.
Right,
it was just a scavenger.
Yes.
Right?
So something that is scavenges only, that does not kill live food. So that hypothesis we can reject for a number of reasons. For one instance, we have these specimens that were attacked while they were alive. Now, granted, they got away, but you're only going to be able to demonstrate that a tyrannosaur or other meat eater attacked a living animal in the case of when it got away, because if it killed it, the wounds on it are going to look identical to scavenging because the animal's dead, and therefore it can't heal. So you can only really test that it went after a living animal if the living animal got away and was able to heal. But some of the specific lines of argumentation that Horner used are what I tried to reevaluate. So the idea that it had tiny little arms and therefore it couldn't capture its prey. Well, I agree. It did not capture its prey with its arms. And why would it? You know, because it's got this gigantic, massive, incredibly adapted skull that is getting in the way of the tiny reach of these wussy little arms. You know, this is its primary weapon.
Yeah.
And, you know, someone needs to tell, you know, wolves and spotted hyenas and snakes and so forth that you can't be a predator without using your forelimbs. Because those animals will all use their jaws, either primarily or in the case of the snakes only, since they don't have forelimbs to use anyway. The teeth are extremely well adapted to smashing through both flesh and bone. They do have a phenomenal sense of smell, or at least Tyrannosaurus had a very large part of their brain devoted to smell, based on our reconstructions of the shape of the brain. And it is true that animals, some scavengers like vultures, have a really good sense of smell. Well, so do predators like wolves. And curiously, the only other group of carnivorous dinosaur that has an equally well-developed sense of smell are the raptors. And unless you want to go ahead and say that Velociraptor and Deinonychus were obligate scavengers, then you can't use very large olfactory lobes as evidence of scavenging.
Right.
Well, you mentioned binocular vision earlier,
right.
that basically they have these more or less forward-looking eyes. What would the use be of that for a scavenger at all? I mean, that's a hunting thing, wouldn't it be?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And in fact, in the case of tyrannosaurs, which have a much better binocular vision than something like allosaurs or ceratosaurs or so forth, it's probably a consequence of the prey they're up against. Because whereas, you know, the allosaurs and so forth are in a world dominated by the long-necked sauropods and by stegosaurs, so big walking walls of meat, they're sort of hard to miss.
Just snack on it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Snip it. Yeah.
Yeah, that if you're up against duckbills, which as far as big herbivores go, were fairly agile, and especially up against triceratops and the other horned dinosaurs. So animals with incredibly fearsome weapons up front, extremely dangerous, then having a precision bite is going to be that much more important.
Wow.
Sure.
I'm just thinking about this. It really is like a bullfight. I mean, you've got to be able to see this. There's a showdown that the horns are facing you. You've got to look at where it's coming at you, or you're going to get that fatal bite in there.
Is there any extant animals that does the same thing a T-Rex did, take a huge chunk of both flesh and bone?
Yeah, the closest would be wolves and especially spotted hyenas.
Oh,
hyenas, which, of course, they have some of the strongest bites of any living predatory land animal, at least. Sort of moving back from the head and the shoulders, tyrannosaurs have exceptionally well-developed leg muscles. They have disproportionately large hip muscles for a carnivorous dinosaur, and they're very long, and for their size, slender legs. So when you see Tyrannosaurus rex, it doesn't look as an adult. It doesn't look as slender. But if you compare it to other comparable size giant dinosaurs, you see it's long and slender. And when you look at young individuals, you see they're very long-legged animals. A bunch of lines of evidence that we've been looking at over the years shows that they were probably faster than the other big carnivorous dinosaurs. And more recently, we've shown they were probably more agile. And this is where that issue of being, you know, the girth rather than length, so to speak, is important. In that by concentrating the mass towards the center of the body and having these great big leg muscles and hip muscles to sort of torque the body around, they could turn and twist and be more agile for their body size than things that are built more like a sausage, where it's sort of harder to get that inertia twisting the whole animal around. And again, this is probably due to the fact that they're up against prey, which themselves are faster moving, at least, and more agile than the sauropods and the stegosaurs were. So sort of an arms race, in this case, actually a leg race between those two.
Hey, but let me ask you this about the long legs, too.
Sure.
Aren't the long legs, I was reading that paper, also an advantage in terms of covering just long distances?
Exactly.
And wouldn't that be more of a scavenging hunting kind of smelling?
No, that's endurance.
Looking?
It's endurance.
Well,
right.
Endurance
scavenging.
To just look and look and look.
So it's sort of an issue of what we found in a paper back in 2020, was that if you look at sort of the cost of transport, the cost of motion with these longer legs, that they could cover more ground with the same amount of energy, which is great for foraging. And whether that's foraging for carcasses or just foraging for herds of other animals, they're both useful.
Extant carnivores have to cover large amount of ground in order to find their prey.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And then at the actual foot itself, so they've got these longer legs, the main long bones of the foot, what we call the metatarsals.
You coined a word.
Yes.
1995, you
heard
the word arctometatarsus.
Yes. Arctometatarsus, that's right.
Which is the middle toe of a theropod foot.
What the heck is that?
Well,
what is
that? Can I guess? Is it because it's the middle toe,
right.
It's a triangular bone, and it's weight-bearing.
Right. So most carnivorous dinosaurs, in fact, most dinosaurs in general, have sort of just cylinders for the metatarsals. And the metatarsals are, in us, the bones of the sole of the feet. But dinosaurs, like cats and dogs and so forth, all walked on the balls of their feet. And so their ankle is held up. And so the metatarsals are the bones that are sticking up for that first joint you see. So in the case of most dinosaurs, all the main weight-bearing metatarsals are about the same length from the top to the bottom, so same width from the top to the bottom. But in a handful of the carnivorous dinosaur group, including tyrannosaurids, troodontids,
ornithomimids,
and then a couple of the oviraptorosaurs, and then these weird-ass tiny little insect eaters called alvarosaurs. They have one where the middle bone is pinched out between the other ones to one degree or other in the top part, and it turns into this wedge at the bottom. And over the years, we've been looking at different functional aspects to that. So my initial thought was that it was primarily to channel the stress up through the foot. And that's why I used arcto. So arctus in Latin in this context is to be compressed or channeled. The subsequent to my work on it, Eric Snively has found another issue is that it sort of locks that foot together more effectively so they can twist more quickly, which is consistent with our later work to show that they were more agile. So they can make a faster turn without sacrificing mechanical strength and by also achieving a longer stride, because all the arctometatarsi are found, which is the plural of arctometatarsus, are proportionately longer than the ordinary style metatarsals in typical carnivorous dinosaurs. So all the ones who have this also have longer feet, and so they're covering more ground with each stride, and distance per time is speed. So we have long, slender, but strong feet in these guys. And a bunch of the rest of us looking at it have found evidence in tyrannosaurs of extra sets of ligaments that are actually entering into the bone slightly, that are binding the metatarsals more strongly together than the equivalent that we see in dinosaurs that don't have an arctometatarsus.
Is this specific to Tyrannosauridae?
So far, the best evidence of it is in Tyrannosaurids. There's some slight evidence of it showing up, but not to the same degree in some of the other arctometatarsal theropods. So we're trying to expand it out now that we know what to look for. So the main contribution, I think, of this paper was the discovery that we could actually find evidence for these extra sets of binding ligaments to sort of snap the foot in together more effectively.
Wait, what's the difference between Tyrannosaurid and Tyrannosauridae?
Sure. Uh-oh. So those are the same. Yes.
Watch out.
So Tyrannosauridae...
Briefly, yeah, Tom. Sure.
Tyrannosauridae is just the formal Latin name, and Tyrannosaurid is just the vernacular, the English form. So okay. It's like the equivalent of Felidae is the family of cats, but we could say felids if we're talking about them informally. But the Tyrannosauridae, this is the group of apex predators with tiny little arms and two-fingered hands, but gigantic body size, and they're nested within a much more extensive group of carnivores called the Tyrannosauroidea, the Tyrannosauroids. And those ones go all the way back to the middle Jurassic, and they start with really small, they include some really small carnivores in them, and it's only at the end of the Cretaceous, the last 20 million years or so, that they evolve and flourish and become the apex predators of the at least Asia and North America as the Tyrannosaurids, or the Tyrannosauridae.
So here in Alaska, we have Nanuksaurus, which is a Tyrannosaurid.
Right.
So I found a tooth of one once. It was a life-changing thing for me. But so I found a Tyrannosaur a Tyrannosaurid?
Both. So Tyrannosaur could be used sort of generically for all of Tyrannosauroidea.
Okay.
However, Tyrannosaurids are part of that group. And in fact, Nanuksaurus and Tyrannosaurus itself are even a subgroup, are part of a subgroup of Tyrannosauridae called Tyrannosaurinae.
Okay,
or the Tyrannosaurines.
Okay. Now you got it.
So here we go. Slippery slope. But what I want to do is let's pivot on our very agile feet. See what I did there?
Yep.
You've made this creature even more formidable. You know, I mean, really, you have protected the king and honored the king. He sounds scary and scary, but really his Achilles heel, so to speak, would be, they always make fun of the tiny arms, all right? So, and there's been a recent paper just came out.
Yeah.
And I guess it was Kevin Padian hypothesized that perhaps it was just, they had the tiny arms, so because when they're feeding at their dinner of
they get in the way.
So what
they'd be eaten by others. But you know what? This speculation to me is so without,
But what is with the tiny arms?
Sure. I think in the broad sense, it's true that the arms would get in the way, that basically the particular suite of adaptations that were favored in tyrannosaurids were emphasizing the skull over the arms. And so the arms had effectively lost any important functional use, and so they're getting smaller and less strong and less of a reach. And who knows, the artist and scientist Greg Paul, you know, decades ago speculated a Cenozoic tyrannosaur, had such a thing existed,
would be a legless lizard.
Yeah, so they have lost them all together. So,
of course, it seems natural.
So that, whether they were adapting to not having them get bitten, which was sort of Pavian's speculation, I think that's sort of hard to demonstrate, but simply the fact that they're no longer required. And so like the wings of a flightless bird that no longer have a primary function, natural selection favors individuals where they're reduced. And in fact, in the Asian cousin of T-Rex, Tarbosaurus, its arms are even proportionally shorter than they are in Tyrannosaurus. So.
Well, a lot of these pushbacks on were the arguments explaining the tiny arms. I think one of the things that I think you were quoted in the some of the pushback too, or hypothesizing, is that proportionally when they're younger, you know, that they grew at different rates, and when they're younger and actually even more agile, but they're going after different prey, their arms were longer as in their youthful days.
Youthful as in just the life cycle of a T-Rex, not
precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and that's an important thing to remember about, you know, dinosaurs in general, and tyrannosaurs, it seems to be a big issue with in particular, is that most of the time I've been talking about it, most of the time most people talk about tyrannosaurus, we're picturing the full-grown 8-ton adult. And sure, and that's an awesome thing to think about. But they didn't just come out of nowhere. They came out of eggs, and a baby T-Rex would presumably be an animal smaller than a human being. And they had to grow between these little guys to these giants, and they had to be able to function at all those stages. And when we look at younger tyrannosaur individuals, their arms are proportionately longer, and the skulls are proportionately weaker. The skulls and teeth are proportionally weaker, which suggests that they are feeding on different prey. And certainly feeding in a different way, that a little, like an 11-year-old, you know, half-ton Tyrannosaurus is not going to be able to take out an adult Triceratops, an adult Edmontosaurus. It would get shattered if it tried to.
Isn't there a word for the difference between juvenile of a species and an adult, the differences?
Sure. So ontogeny is our general word for the changes of an organism through its life cycle.
Got it.
And what I and others have speculated on is that many dinosaurs, and tyrannosaurs included, went through what we call ontogenetic niche shifts, which is something
that
which is something that we see in a lot of animals today that have multiple sizes, that where the babies are a lot smaller than the adults. Now, in mammals, we typically don't see it because mammals, even if they start off very small, like a baby bear is quite a small animal compared to the adult, but they're provisioned by mom until they're big enough to live on their own, and they're almost as big as an adult at that stage.
And baby elephants can fly when they're very small.
Exactly. I've seen it in the movies, both in cartoons and in CG, so it must be true.
Yeah.
So a mammal, it's less important. That they are effectively not a different, they're not functioning differently in the ecology because mom or the herd or whoever is taking care of them. But in the case of alligators and Komodo dragons today, and a lot of dinosaurs of the past, they have had parental care for a while. Alligators have parental care for several weeks after they're born, But eventually they're off on their own, and alligators' diets change. You know, they start by going after like tadpoles and small fish and insects, and eventually they start adding in crustaceans like crayfish and turtles, and then eventually, you know, they're getting golfers. And then Komodo dragons, they start off hiding up in the trees because the adult Komodo dragons would eat them if they were on the ground, and they're going after insects and birds. And eventually, when they're big enough, they come down out of the trees and they're going after snakes and rodents. And when they're really big enough, they're going after, you know, goats and deer and the occasional tourist and baby Komodo dragons. And so what many of us have speculated with and have begun to try to show is that tyrannosaurs in particular went through some big anatomical changes through their life. So that they presumably, like many dinosaurs, probably had parental care, at least for several months or weeks or months. But eventually they're probably, in most species, out on their own, feeding on their own. And early on, they're these small animals. So they're going after mammals and so forth, getting a little bigger. Maybe they start taking on turtles and small dinosaurs and so forth. When they get to the size of something like Jane, who was a 11 to 12 year old individual of probably Tyrannosaurus, that's at the Burpee Museum at Rockford, Illinois, big enough to go after ostrich dinosaurs like Ornithomimus and Struthiomimus and Leptoceratops and young Edmontosaurus and young Triceratops and so forth, but not able to crunch through an Ankylosaurus's armor and not powerful enough in terms of its jaws to take out the throat of an adult Edmontosaurus, and certainly nowhere up to going after a big Triceratops. And then when they're adults, they're able to take on those big animals. But when they're adults, they're probably not able to capture, you know, Leptoceratops, which is smaller than a human being.
I have a competition question.
Sure.
So the last species of T-Rex was pretty much the Maastrichtian.
Right.
Right. Which is the last age of the Cretaceous period. So why? Why T-Rex? Were there any carnivores in early Cretaceous or early late Cretaceous? Why was it the Tyrannosaurids that became the apex predator? Is there any competition from any other carnivore, let's say, in the Mesozoic?
Yeah, well, that's one of the weird things. So I've pointed out for a couple decades, and in recent years, this subject has got a lot more particular attention by myself and by Kat Schrader and others, is the makeup of the guild, the association of predator, of dinosaur and predators, and how they've shifted through time. And if you look back in the Jurassic and in the early Cretaceous, you would typically have several different large carnivores inhabiting the same environment at the same time from multiple groups of carnivores. So you go back to the Morrison Formation, you go back to the late Jurassic of Utah and Colorado and so forth, and you've got Allosaurus, super common. You've got Torvosaurus, who's a big bruiser. So Allosaurus is an Allosaurid. Torvosaurus is a Megalosaurid. Ceratosaurus is a Ceratosaurid. You've got Marchesaurus, which is a Megalosaurid, which is a little smaller. You've got Stoxosaurus, which is an early Tyrannosaur, which is smaller still, and so forth, all inhabiting the same environment. And so each of them has their own diverse role.
Right.
So they have their own prey niche?
Dan, that's the question. They're probably going after certain specific prey items, and they're probably hunting in specific fashions. And then that sort of pattern is common through the early Cretaceous, and then there's the new twilight zone, the time that we still don't have very many good samples, which is sort of like the mid part of the late Cretaceous, poorly known for dinosaur fossils around the world. We come out of that, and in Western North America and in Eastern and Central Asia, we have tyrannosaurs as apex predators, and then the next largest predators are like an order of magnitude or two smaller.
And well, they would be what? They've been triumphant.
They're kings. So, but what was next in line?
Yeah, so the next largest ones would be dromaeosaurs, so raptors.
Right.
In North America, up until the end of the Maastrichtian, there aren't any really big raptors. Most of them are smaller than human beings. At the very end, there's this Forum Dakota raptor that shows up, which is bigger than a human being. Still dwarfed by Tyrannosaurus. But, and it's about the only thing that occupies that middle spectrum. And
but
so,
if they're smart and hunting in packs, they're going to have a totally different niche of prey than this giant monster. I mean, a T-Rex is a monster.
Right. And so what I'd speculated on, and others have found evidence for that, is that effectively the Tyrannosaur young were occupying these middle niches in the ecosystem and effectively acting as different species, even though biologically they're the same species as the adults.
Yeah, when we had Jack Horner on, he kind of came around to that too. We talked at length about the predator-prey thing, but also the fact that the idea that maybe it was the young that inhabited this niche and the young killed different things and basically, but toward at the end of the very end of the Cretaceous, right before the old asteroid hits, it's a global thing that tyrannosaurids are ruling in that niche around the entire planet, Tom?
No, so tyrannosaurids are dominating in Western North America and in Eastern and Central Asia. Over here, where I am, in the eastern part of North America, we don't know the dinosaurs of the Maastrichtian as well, but we do have evidence of a group of tyrannosaurs, although they're not tyrannosaurids, called the dryptosaurids, that are seem to be the largest predator.
Oh.
But what we do know of them is that they were smaller than tyrannosaurids, they were slender, and they had great big claws, great big thumb claws, although the arms were short.
Mm.
So we really want to find a good skeleton of one of them someday.
Isn't there a T-Rex found in New Jersey at Kenneth Lacovara's site?
It's probably Dryptosaurus material that they found there.
Right, it's
not impossible, because the great seaway that had separated North America from most of the Cretaceous had mostly drained away at the very end. So no one's going to be super surprised if you find T-Rex and Triceratops in the east at the very end, but we haven't yet demonstrated that.
I want to ask a super nerdy question that's drilling down on a very subtle detail. Dinosaur geeks want to know this. Did Tyrannosaurus Rex, and it sounds a little silly when I ask it, did it have lips, Tom? When it closed its mouth, I draw a lot of dinosaurs. I started drawing them at age 4. When it closes its mouth, could you see its teeth?
Yeah, I plead the fifth. No, this is what I know.
Could you, sir?
Yes, I have seen arguments from both sides, from both the people who think that they may have been more like crocodilians, where the teeth are exposed.
Yes.
And it's true that, you know, certainly modern crocodilians are lipless, birds are lipless, because they have beaks. So we don't know of the presence of lips in definite archosaurs, which would include dinosaurs. Now, both
The closest comparative anatomy to a T-Rex?
Well, here, let me give you this. So when you see a Komodo dragon and it closes its, it even opens its mouth, you don't see the teeth. And I noticed that in Prehistoric Planet, the BBC series, their Tyrannosaurus, I was watching very closely. Yep. It closed its mouth and like, oh, they got lips.
The Komodos don't have daggers like T-Rexes.
Yeah, but actually, when you look at the skull, that's the thing. You look at the skull of a Komodo dragon or another monitor lizard, they have proportionally huge teeth.
Right.
But it turns out in life, they also have really deep gums. And then they also have these lips that are coming down, these lizard lips that sort of seal off the mouth. And we can't exclude those kind of lips from early members of the crocodilian lineage or from other dinosaurs. Right. We don't have the right impressions of the skull, the skin of the skull, to say for
sure.
So
it's okay that I'm still drawing in with the teeth, huh? I just want a clearance that it's okay. Yeah. I don't have to change all my stuff. Thank you.
I've got another nerdy question. So when I very rarely look at Instagram, about 5 minutes a day, there is a channel called Nature is Metal. The natural world, and they'll show these. I just saw today wolf dogs tearing apart an antelope.
Not wolf dogs, they're African, African wild dogs.
Oh, right, Lycaon pictus.
Thank you. They're ripping an antelope alive. They're ripping it to death alive and eating it alive, and then the hyenas come in and finish the job. So how come we've never, or is there an animation of a T-Rex really digging into a live hadrosaur with all the blood and guts and ripping of flesh? I mean, it's always implied,
I never remember the camera cuts away. The camera cuts away, or you go in like the Disney approach when it was a stegosaurus. But hey, you go into the eye and you see the eye fading out or whatever.
Yeah,
Fantasia. So yeah, I think that has more to do with the target audience rather than reality. That in reality, you would have had cases of the animals, screaming as their bellies are being pulled out bit by bit.
But the reason why I asked it. This is why T-Rex is so formidable in our psyche. Mm-hmm. It's because it did that. It is a true living monster. It is literally stuff of nightmares. And when you look at the size, when you stand next to the skull in the Smithsonian or at the Museum of the Rockies, you realize this thing could bite you in half.
Mm-hmm.
It takes down other monsters. And I think that's why I want to see how it truly, really ate in life. That's why I'd like to see that type of video or animation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's something that I'm sure the animators would be interested in doing, but people who are paying them do the animation.
Yeah. Paleo nerds could, our vast resources, could do the really, the truly...
Yeah.
T-Rex Uncensored.
Right. Exactly.
Yes, see it all.
Right.
I think I could keep going about T-Rex for a long time. So I'm just going to, jump right into the time travel question, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
What epic epoch, what perfect paleo period, what awesome age would you want to go back to, and what would you want to see, presuming you could time travel, sir?
Well,
you can't pick Bestrickian.
That's unfair, dude. Yeah, what did you want to see? What? Sure. Maybe you want to see that. I'm just curious.
I do. Yeah. No, honestly, for obvious reasons, the Hell Creek fauna has always intrigued me so much. That said, so to pick a second, that's a good question. And I think, the natural next response as a dinosaur worker is the Morrison, so the Late Cretaceous of Western North America. But I'm going to go different. And I'm going to go to northeast China at the time of the Ixian Formation, which is where we get most of the good feather.
Zhihou biota?
Yeah, the Zhihou biota. In part because although we know all the little guys pretty well, or we know a lot about them, because that's what's getting preserved in these lakes, are the little ones, we know sort of diddly squat, or maybe a little squat, but not much more than that, of the giant dinosaurs. Which were obviously there. There's no reason to think they weren't there.
Right.
But because of the style of preservation, we're not seeing them. And so to see what those creatures were like that were inhabiting that world, sort of setting the foundations of the Late Cretaceous, would be a really wonderful thing to see in person. And then after that, just as not a dinosaur paleontologist, but a paleontologist in general, assuming I had the appropriate oxygen support, would be to go back to the Ediacaran. So before the Cambrian, before the Cambrian explosion, when animal life is present, but not any of the major groups that we have around today. What exactly is going on with these things? There's a question.
I was just there 2 weeks ago.
Oh,
I was
cool.
at the South Australian Museum and saw Dickinsonia there.
Right.
And you know what's crazy? It's not behind glass walls.
Oh, wow.
I literally just had to really keep myself from touching it.
Rubbing away the fossil.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, to see that world, what was it like before the rise of predation? There's only a handful of creatures that are doing anything as sophisticated as sort of scraping around the algae. And additionally, that's one time you can go into the ancient past and probably not worry about too much.
There's not going to be anything that you'd have to worry about.
Exactly. Yeah, there's going to be so little oxygen in the atmosphere that you're going to need that support. And of course, all the interesting life forms that we know of are underwater at that time. So you're going to need scuba or at least snorkeling. So.
Well, that's great. From the Cretaceous to the Ediacaran, that's quite a big span of time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, my question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while researching for your interview, Tom, I found myself swallowed into your YouTube gullet. I was blown away by the sheer number of your lectures and content there, and I counted over 120 lectures on subjects ranging from geology to climate change and, of course, quite a few on Tyrannosauridae.
Mm-hmm.
But what in really intrigued me was your lecture on pseudoscience.
Ah, yes.
Now, hold on. I think I know why you lecture this subject, but can you please briefly explain to our listeners why this is such an important topic? And what do you mean by the role of speculation and wonder in science, and why is it important?
Sure. So, you know, as a kid, I was super into not just dinosaurs, but UFOs and Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and ancient astronauts and stuff. You know, as a kid in the late 60s and especially in the 70s and that sort of